You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun.
Another escalation of tensions between the U.S. and China.
Chinese-U.S. relations are at a historical low. They have never been as bad as they are now in the past 40 years.
So this was a long time coming. The United States' relationship with China has been deteriorating for years. I worked for the State Department under the Clinton administration. I spent years working in East Asian politics and diplomacy. And if you ask me why this is happening now, well, I tell you that the U.S. and China have been misunderstanding and mistrusting each other for years. These are two countries with very different traditions, culture, and arguably worldviews. And amid pandemic, global recession, seismic technology changes, and waves of political unrest, Americans and Chinese alike are feeling that their own country is particularly vulnerable to the other right now. Increasingly, Hong Kong is becoming the focal point of the world's most important bilateral relationship. And without serious attention, the situation is only going to get worse. A few weeks ago, Xi Jinping's government issued a new security law that's as wide-reaching as it is vague. Among other things, protesters are banned from the streets and have been threatened with life imprisonment. Beijing has taken over the Hong Kong courts. China sees these massive demonstrations as an internal security matter. But for the U.S. and thousands upon thousands of Hong Kongers, this is an attack on liberal democratic values.
General Secretary Xi Jinping made a choice to violate the Chinese Communist Party's promises to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong will now be treated the same as mainland China. No special privileges, no special economic treatment.
Well, China says its response to all this will include sanctions on people and entities in the U.S.
This week, we're taking a closer look at Hong Kong's security law, what it means for the millions of people in Hong Kong, and how it could impact U.S.-China relations. Ray Suarez starts us off with an interview with Sophie Richardson, the China director at Human Rights Watch.
Sophie Richardson keeps an eye on developments throughout Southeast and East Asia. She's the author of China, Cambodia, and the Five Principles of Peaceful Coexistence. Sophie Richardson, welcome to World Affairs.
It's great to be here with you.
You know, the bilateral relationship between any two countries in the world would be pretty heavily burdened if just one of these problems was on their platter. But the relationship between the United States and China is at a crossroads over trade, over the new security law in Hong Kong, over the handling in China and in the United States of COVID-19, and many other issues. It's a pretty heavy burden. Are we at a crossroads?
You know, we ran out of metaphors probably about a year ago after saying for the umpteenth time that the relationship was about to go over a cliff. I think it is fair to say that the bilateral relationship is at its worst at any point, really, since the reemergence of China post-Cultural Revolution onto the world stage. But from our perspective, it's the human rights deteriorations under President Xi Jinping and really the relative lack of a response until fairly recently to those from the rest of the world that takes up a lot of our focus.
Last week, the President of the United States announced he was signing the Hong Kong Autonomy Act, sanctioned Chinese officials and banks, and signed an executive order that ended Hong Kong's preferential trade status. This is pretty big stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, these are some of the toughest measures any U.S. administration has ever taken. I think there are some open questions about what the net effects of those decisions really are going to be. Again, from a human rights perspective, the decisions back in October 2019 to put a number of Chinese tech companies and the entire police department for the Xinjiang region, which is the part of the country where Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities live and who've suffered terrible persecution, seeing those entities get sanctioned just last week the administration announced that for the first time it was going to impose sanctions on 4 Chinese government officials and another entity under the Global Magnitsky Act, which is designed to speak to human rights violations. You know, those are steps that really, in our view, raise the price of committing human rights violations on individual government officials, you know, and on those entities. And that, we think, is constructive.
But I'm wondering, you know, in civil society in the United States, in elected official circles of people who were keeping an eye on Hong Kong and China, there was a desire to keep Hong Kong special, keep Hong Kong separate, keep talking about it as if it was separate, keep treating it as if it was separate. By taking these steps, has the Trump administration sort of said, all right, well, China, you've started to make Hong Kong less special. We're recognizing that you've done that, and we're taking away these signposts, these markers that the United States looked at it separately as well.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit, because what really made Hong Kong separate was law. Hong Kong was guaranteed human rights and, you know, the ability to make decisions about issues in Hong Kong itself. And let's be very clear. It is the Chinese government that has undermined and repeatedly violated those principles and those realities. And I think Hong Kong has really resonated very differently in the international imagination, particularly as this draconian new national security law has gone into effect after we watched the protests last summer. You know, people all over the world have visited Hong Kong or lived there or worked there, and I think have a different kind of connection to it than they do to, for example, Xinjiang or Tibet, maybe. And so, you know, there's a very strong response around these encroachments on Hong Kong. But I think it would not be accurate to suggest that it's the U.S. or any other government that's driving an effort to separate Hong Kong, you know, either from its special status or from the rest of the world. That is the Chinese government's strategy. That's its goal. The burden is on Beijing. It is the one that's really tried to gut this law.
The Beijing government imposed the new security measures on June 30th. What do you hear? What's changed about the daily life of a Hong Konger since China went ahead and implemented that set of laws?
Well, at 11:59 p.m. On June 30th, you could still, as a Hong Konger, walk out onto the street and hold up a banner that was critical of the Chinese government and hope that, you know, your right to do that would be respected, because for a long time, human rights and civil liberties in that territory have been respected and buttressed by a free media and an independent judiciary. Well, at 12:01 a.m. on July 1st, you could do exactly the same thing and find yourself subject to prosecution under a law that is literally boundless in setting out sedition, subversion, terrorism, foreign collusion, that allows for cases to be tried by mainland authorities, that's meant to be, you know, upheld extraterritorially. You know, in theory, the conversation you and I are having right now could be considered a violation of that law, and Chinese authorities could expect that you and I would be prosecuted for having it.
Something to think about when I next visit China.
Indeed.
The old thinking was that even though China wasn't very happy with the setup, it wouldn't dare to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. It was willing to put up with a certain amount of ruckus, a certain amount of cultural freedom, a certain amount of inconvenient political messaging, free newspapers, that it was sort of the cost of doing business. But the mainland economy grew in a way that I think the last British governor of Hong Kong, Chris Patten, couldn't have imagined in the following 20 years. Is this a rounding error now for China, where they don't have to put up with what they see as sedition, as dangerous foreign influence, and so on?
Yeah, I think that to the extent that businesses might leave Hong Kong, or that certain kinds of trade privileges could get stripped away. I think Beijing factored that into the equation. You know, it's built into the business model. And I think what became absolutely intolerable from the Chinese government's perspective, you know, the very persistent efforts, probably best seen through the protests last summer, for political rights, for greater democratization. Even the Beijing-appointed figures in the Hong Kong government couldn't get people off the streets. And so Beijing really went with the nuclear option to essentially criminalize whatever it wants, whenever it wants, under this new law. And, you know, it will certainly be interesting to see how big businesses, banks, the kinds of international firms that have had a presence in Hong Kong for a long time react, whether they move elsewhere. But I think that's a cost that Beijing is perfectly willing to absorb in order to impose the kind of political loyalty it wants to see coming from Hong Kong.
So from the tone of our conversation so far, it sounds like the 50-year period lasted about 23 years. It made it almost to the halfway point. If you're a young person in Hong Kong, this must be a tremendously depressing moment where now you look out ahead, unfolding adult life, and know that this place is just going to be very different.
Yeah, it's a very different reality than it was even just a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, let me be clear, nobody expected the national security law to be a positive step for human rights. But I think even we had underestimated just how bad it was going to be and what the ramifications were going to be. You know, I think if Beijing had wanted to offer up a law that would cause less controversy, it would have written one that was much more narrowly drawn. What it's done is essentially impose a law, you know, that does not make clear what isn't a violation. And so now people find themselves wondering what they can say, what they can do, where they can go, who they can associate with. What happens if they take a job at a company that's identified itself as being sympathetic to, you know, the pro-democratic political parties in Hong Kong? What happens if they engage in a protest on a campus? And I think if you're a young person in Hong Kong and you had expectations either, you know, that there wouldn't necessarily be much more political space, you maybe assumed that there wasn't necessarily going to be a whole lot less. But we've wound up in a place now where people are extremely vulnerable in going about certain kinds of civic or political activities that 2 weeks ago were considered perfectly normal and indeed cherished. And you know, people in Hong Kong take the idea of human rights and civil liberties very seriously and have clearly acted on them. And they're in an incredibly different and dangerous operating environment now.
Did the world wimp out? Did the rest of the world looking on as this happened soft pedal the response to Beijing just because it's now an incredibly powerful economic player and an increasingly powerful diplomatic player? You know, there just wasn't much upside to defending the civil rights of Hong Kong people.
Well, I think for far too long, too many governments, you know, that would offer up rhetorical concern about human rights in China. And that whether it was about religious freedom, whether it was about Hong Kong, you know, whether it was about individuals like the Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo, who died just over 3 years ago after being wrongfully detained. You know, governments would often, you know, say the right things and express concern, but they've long been loath to impose real consequences in response to human rights violations. I think that's starting to change, not just because of developments like Hong Kong, you know, which is distinct partly because there is a binding treaty with the UK, you know, and because people have a certain kind of connection to Hong Kong that they don't necessarily to other human rights violations. But I think the pandemic has changed some perceptions about the Chinese government and its conduct, whether it was sufficiently transparent early enough, whether the COVID crisis would have played out differently if China had tolerated whistleblowers and shared information more promptly. You know, that's a set of human rights abuses inside China that's had consequences all over the world. And I think it's changed some perceptions. I think one of the other variables is, you know, very aggressive diplomacy by Chinese government officials in certain circumstances or on particular issues that's really rubbed some governments the wrong way. And so we're starting to see moves towards things like sanctions or providing safe haven for people from Hong Kong or other kinds of punitive measures in response for human rights violations. I think there's a big question about how effective any of that is going to be with a government that's as powerful and as affluent as Xi Jinping's government is.
I'm glad you brought up the UK, because they've played a very interesting game throughout this period. In the 1990s, when the talks were ongoing between various British governments and the government in Beijing, there was a lot of anxiety in Britain about millions of Hong Kong Chinese who were then British passport holders wanting to come to the home islands. And it was made very clear that Hong Kong people could not move as landed immigrants to Britain. And their visa status became more precarious as a way of making it clear, hey, make your future in Hong Kong. It isn't going to be here. Through the period, various British politicians have had a lot to say about what China's been up to. But they've also been accused of being a little sotto voce because a newly freed from the EU Britain is going to want China as a trading partner, not want any encumbrances on that relationship. And even in the face of that, Britain has opened the door a crack and made it somewhat clear that Hong Kong Chinese, under certain provisions, will be able to move to the British Isles. This after an EU departure referendum that was hotly contested over immigration. When I read what the British were up to, I got to tell you, I covered the Hong Kong transition pretty closely. I was a little surprised, given all the anxiety in Britain about immigration. Whether it's realistic as a bolt hole for large numbers of Hong Kong Chinese is unclear, but still, it was sticking their neck out a little, no?
It's interesting to think back to 1984, when the Sino-British Joint Declaration was signed, you know, a time at which it was unthinkable that the UK would leave the EU, for example, right? And it's I think, a powerful metaphor for how the world has changed, but also that, you know, a concern that people in the UK may have had at that time about, you know, hundreds of thousands of Hong Kongers moving to the UK has sort of come full circle. You know, this is the current government in London is not one that's very big on immigration. And yet, I think that is, you know, that's been seen as an important moral obligation, you know, something that we don't talk about a lot these days. But also that the Hong Kong developments come after, you know, an incredible skirmish in the UK about Huawei, for example, and concerns about what engagement with big Chinese technology firms might mean for the UK's security. You know, it comes after the UK engaging on some other, you know, complicated topics, including some human rights issues, and, you know, getting pretty serious blowback from Beijing. You know, there are a group of members of parliament, really on both sides of the aisle, so to speak, who I think feel very strongly that the UK needs to push back forcefully against the Chinese government at this particular point in time. And the speed with which the announcement about the Hong Kongers with BNO status, who had status to come to the UK, was pretty swift. And, you know, there's a long way to go before lots of the people who are entitled to that status actually relocate to the UK and whether they can expect to be, you know, really welcomed and resettled. But it was, I agree that it was sort of a remarkable statement about where we are, I think, in modern history in that particular bilateral relationship.
If you were a Hong Kong citizen and you woke up on the morning of July 1st and considered your possibilities, is getting out of there one of them? Is it difficult to go other places in the world? It seems like borders, for the moment, have gotten a lot tighter in the world, that the world is not a wide open place any longer.
I think that's true generally, but also made that much more complex in the time of COVID, when lots of countries are closed, even for people who are seeking temporary refuge. And to me, it's telling that in the US and in other countries, members of parliaments have moved very quickly to try to put in place new strategies that would allow people from Hong Kong, you know, whether for political reasons, for economic reasons, for other reasons, want to be able to go to those countries. There's legislation under discussion in at least a half dozen different countries. The government in Taiwan has welcomed people. And I think it is to at least give people in Hong Kong a sense that, you know, if the life they can live under Chinese rule is not one they want, there are other places that will welcome them.
One exception, in an odd way, has been the United States until just the other day. With a stroke of the pen, the White House threatened to basically send home thousands of foreign students in the country, including Hong Kong Chinese and mainlanders who were studying in the United States. It really threw a monkey wrench in the works of a lot of individuals' lives. They've since backed off under pressure from a lot of American higher ed. Students have been the pointy end of the spear in Hong Kong's civil disobedience over the last couple of months. Do you expect that they will be now toning that down, because it's now dangerous to do?
Well, I think we're probably not going to see protests of the order of magnitude that we did last year. And certainly, you know, some of the student or youth activists who were very involved in protests, I think, are having to make difficult choices now about whether and how to stay engaged. You know, one of the most, I think, depressing developments, you know, in the hours before the contents of the law were finally made public, you know, was watching organizations like Democisto, one of the political parties that grew out of activism around universal suffrage in Hong Kong over the last couple of years, you know, and some other terrific civil society groups announced that they were dissolving themselves in order to avoid being prosecuted under the new law. And, you know, I've sort of long been of the view that organizations like these are the loyal opposition of a sane government's dreams, right? These are, you know, these are largely organizations that are deeply devoted to civic causes, to, you know, engaging and assisting vulnerable populations. You know, they're groups that are using their human rights and their civil liberties in peaceful ways, you know, to make places like Hong Kong better for everybody. And that even they can't feel like they can't exist safely under this new regime is just an extraordinary step backwards.
Is it fair to say that part of the world's confidence around the time of the handover was that someday Hong Kong becoming an unremarkable part of China wasn't such a big deal, because China was getting rich, and as societies get rich, they normally get freer? Is it turning out that China's going to get rich without getting free? And that's part of the anxiety that's accompanying this faster timetable to Hong Kong being absorbed into the rest of China.
Yeah, I think the belief that if China became more affluent and more integrated in the rest of the world, it would become that the government would become more politically tolerant was spectacularly wrong. But I think one of the other difficulties is that that was spectacularly wrong as of about 10 years ago. And it's really taken, I think, a lot of, you know, governments and political actors a long time to come to grips with that reality. And in a way, I think Hong Kong is the starkest example of how wrong that assumption was about the relationship between economic development and political respect for political rights. I mean, China is now the second largest economy in the world, but it's also a government that has existed for, you know, more than seven decades without deigning to have a popular election. It's a government that will not tolerate independent media or emancipate the legal system to hold people accountable. It's extraordinary how modest gains around human rights, you know, in roughly the 1990s, the 2000s, have not just sputtered under Xi Jinping, but radically reversed. Look at the pervasive high-tech state surveillance that's now in use. You know, and I think that in a way is a powerful example of, you know, how an authoritarian government like Xi Jinping's will deploy its resources, you know, extraordinary resources, to deny people their rights.
Well, like a cat with a tiny toy, China could have done this any old time. Why are they doing it now? Is this a statement of their self-confidence and their message to the rest of the world that they are big enough, strong enough, and rich enough to play by their own rules like that other country does? Or is something else going on? Is the pandemic an issue, a catalyst, a cover for them pulling some of this off?
Well, I think COVID has been a good excuse for Beijing to advance certain goals while the rest of the world was looking the other way. But there were two, I think, particular issues for Beijing about Hong Kong right now. The first was that they did not want to see more protests this summer ahead of the Legislative Council elections that are slated for September, in which pro-democracy voices or parties are expected to do quite well. You may recall that earlier this year, the district council elections in Hong Kong, and these are positions that don't really have a great deal of power or authority, prompted record turnout in a gesture that was largely seen as Hong Kong people asserting their right to participate and choose who they wanted to choose. And I think Beijing looked at the first anniversary of the protests coming up this summer, the anniversary of the handover from Britain to China, and looked at the possibility of an elected LegCo that was not going to be particularly pliant from Beijing's perspective. And they decided to simply impose this law that would take care of all of those problems in one fell swoop.
What will you be looking for in how China runs Hong Kong and how China deals with Hong Kong to know what its intentions are near and medium term?
Well, I think our top priority is to track actual prosecutions under the national security law to see how it's actually going to be used. But I think we also want very much to continue to support civil society efforts to use whatever space is left. But also, you know, this is a critically important goal, not just for Hong Kong, but for Xinjiang, for Tibet, for human rights defenders across China. You know, sadly, Hong Kong is not the only major human rights crisis we're dealing with, is that it is absolutely time. It is past time for the Chinese government to be held accountable at UN bodies, particularly the United Nations Human Rights Council, in the way any other government has been or should be. Or the Chinese government has gotten away without much serious scrutiny at that body, partly because it's very powerful within the body. It discourages other governments from criticizing it or pushing for the same kind of accountability mechanisms that we've just seen, you know, quite a diversity of governments worldwide and in Human Rights Watch's view correctly support an investigation into racism and police violence here in the U.S. If one P5 member state can be held accountable and scrutinized at the Human Rights Council, they all should be. And it's high time that the Chinese government had to answer, not just for what it's done with human rights in Hong Kong. It should answer for its arbitrary detention of a million Uyghurs and other Turkic Muslims in Xinjiang. It should answer for the appalling restrictions on religious freedom of Tibetans and people of other faiths. It should have to answer for the deaths of human rights defenders in detention. You know, the Chinese government cannot be allowed to continue enjoying the kind of impunity that it's gotten used to, because what's happened as a result of that? More abuses.
Sophie Richardson is the China director at Human Rights Watch. Thanks a lot for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the weekly broadcast of World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yun. We just heard from Sophie Richardson, the China director for Human Rights Watch. She's the author of China, Cambodia, and the Five Principles of Peaceful Coexistence. Richardson warns that U.S.-China relations are at their worst point since the Cold War, and that Hong Kong's security law is making it worse. But if you really want to understand the impact of a law like this, you have to talk to Hong Kongers themselves. World Affairs' Teresa Casarillas takes it from here.
The national security law actually happened on my birthday, and the first thing that my mother said to me was, you know, happy birthday, this may be the gloomiest day for Hong Kong.
Claire's an artist and an activist, and she was raised in Hong Kong. Her grandmother fled there from communist China in the 1950s, and most of Claire's family still lives in the city. Her parents, siblings, aunts and uncles.
Hong Kong is a really special place. First of all, it's this beautiful city on the water. It's basically mountains and islands, and then this, you know, city just springing up in between the mountains. It is highly efficient, amazing public transit. You get trains every 2 minutes. Amazing food. As like a former British colony, we've had like some kind of weird concoctions, things like egg tarts and coconut cream filled baked buns, you know, all of these different things. I just love walking along the Tsing Mun River, 30, 40 story buildings on either side.
Claire lives in the U.S. now, which is one of the reasons she feels comfortable talking to us. She also asked that we only use her first name to protect her and her family. Under Hong Kong's new security law, and I quote, secession, subversion, organization and perpetration of terrorist activities, and collusion with a foreign country, end quote, are all illegal. They're also vaguely defined.
Any criticism of the, you know, Chinese Communist Party, the authoritarian regime, could be deemed as subversion. And that, I think, is a major point of fear for my family, their academics. You know, any academic research and criticism they could do could be construed as that.
Claire's also not sure what the Chinese government would even consider colluding with a foreign country under this new law.
I live abroad. You know, will any communication that I have with my family be construed as, you know, collusion with foreign forces? A lot of people have like changed their channels of communication because they're concerned that using WhatsApp, that all of the data can be intercepted.
Her parents are already talking about leaving.
Saying like, oh, we don't know if we can stay in Hong Kong long term, but we don't know where to move to. But we feel like we want to fight for Hong Kong and do everything we can to fight for Hong Kong. I definitely have this internal conflict of wanting to be there and fight. Growing up, I used to always go to June 4th vigils, the Tiananmen massacre vigils, and we would do that every year. And then on July 1st, we would always go to one of the pro-democracy marches.
She was still living in Hong Kong in 2014 when the Umbrella Movement brought the city to a standstill. In a series of mass pro-democracy protests, students pushed for Hong Kong's right to pick its own leaders.
I went with my parents, and we didn't really know where to go. More and more people kept coming in behind us. One person who had the megaphone said, like, everybody sit down, we will occupy these streets by sitting down. So basically, we stopped traffic, and then a line of police started coming to the front, and just like I saw a huge line of policemen just lined up in front of the protesters. And by that point, I think there were like thousands of people just in my view. We were there for maybe about 2 hours, and I was like, I needed to find a restroom. So I went into like a mall nearby, and just as I was exiting the mall, I was hearing people screaming and saying like, tear gas, tear gas, they're using tear gas. And people were just like running into the building.
Last night, there were clashes between protesters and the authorities. Police fired tear gas and pepper spray into the crowd.
The pictures are simply incredible coming out of one of the world's major financial centers.
I had friends who came out after they started tear gassing because they were angry. And then people started occupying, having tents, sleeping overnight. It basically became like a village. There was trash and recycling sorted. People had supplies they donated into the bathrooms. There was even like a windmill that was somebody built to provide electricity at night for students to study, you know, with desks and lamps. And there was artwork exploding everywhere. It was really beautiful.
Claire says Hong Kong's protest movement has gotten more militant since then. She says it's also more widely supported. Last year, Hong Kong's government introduced a bill that would have allowed extraditions to mainland China, prompting months of ongoing mass protest.
There were like 2 million people out on the streets, and that's a quarter of Hong Kong's population.
Claire's protested in the United States too, and she sees parallels between the mass protests in Hong Kong and the Black Lives Matter movement here. The protesters' goals are fundamentally different, but they share some tactics and challenges.
In both cases, it seemed like whenever the police would show up, that's actually when things would get violent. Otherwise, for the most part, the protests were very peaceful. I will say that for Hong Kong, what has worked really well in the past year is not having a clear plan in advance and letting things kind of, you know, basically people would just say, let's meet at these places tomorrow or this evening, and people would just gather.
While 2014's umbrella movement had clear leadership, Hong Kong's current protest movement is more decentralized. Organizers say that makes it harder for authorities to crack down on it or control it.
I have friends in the U.S. in this, you know, more recent wave of Black Lives Matter who are like, oh, what's that going to accomplish? And I'm like, well, no, actually, when enough people get out to the streets, like it can usually accomplish something. And we have seen a huge change in the conversation. Don't give up, because every step of that movement that you take will lead to something else.
Claire's just not sure what the Hong Kong opposition movement is building towards now. The security law is just too new. She's hoping international pressure will build against the Chinese government. And she's part of an organization of Hong Kong expats who are advocating for their city's civil liberties from abroad. For now, her parents and siblings are planning to stick it out in Hong Kong. Her dad's already talking about protesting again.
For now, I think my family is probably going to stay, and we'll just see how bad things get.
As Beijing tightens its hold on Hong Kong, this security law represents more than a crackdown on political freedoms. For thousands of Hong Kongers like Claire, it's also a broken promise. Hong Kong was supposed to retain its autonomy for 50 years after the 1997 handover from British rule. At the time, Western political leaders hoped that China would become more democratic as its economy liberalized. By the time those 50 years were up, Hong Kong and the mainland might not be so different. Those political leaders appear to be wrong, And critics say that this security law could mark the end of that one country, two systems agreement. It's important to understand how we got here. Earlier this year, journalist Mary Kay Magstad sat down with Jeffrey Wasserstrom, a history professor at UC Irvine specializing in modern China. He broke down Hong Kong's global significance and how it's played into China's wider ambitions. This was recorded back in February, before the pandemic and before the security law, but it's all the more relevant now. Mary Kay Magstad starts us off with some background.
Hong Kong came under British control when Britain won the Opium War against China in the 1840s.
For Hong Kong on its 2,000-foot mountain is often called the Gibraltar of the Far East.
Back then, Hong Kong was barely more than a village of 7,500 people, but it had a good harbor and access to the Chinese coast.
Important to West and Far East alike, the colony holds a position anomalous and unique in international commerce.
Hong Kong grew into a financial center and eventually into a world-class business hub. And then, on June 30th, 1997, Hong Kong returned from British to Chinese control. It was pouring rain, sheets of rain, that night. I was there, out in the streets, getting soaked. Hong Kong's British governor, Chris Patten, was out in the rain. He said in an emotional moment on his way out,
"Now, Hong Kong people are to run Hong Kong. That is the promise, and that is the unshakable destiny."
I watched at the stroke of midnight in the Hong Kong Convention Center as Britain's flag was lowered down one flagpole and the Chinese flag rose on the other. And I saw in the early morning light the first Chinese troops cross into Hong Kong. People weren't sure what to expect back then. Some had already left. Some were anxious. Others were actually glad to see the British go, and they hoped for the best. After all, Britain and China had made a deal that Hong Kong could keep its own way of life for 50 years after the handover, that Hong Kong and China would be one country with two systems. They even agreed, in vague terms, that Hong Kong people would eventually be able to elect their own government, one person, one vote, universal suffrage. And China did give Hong Kong space at first, but no universal suffrage and no real choice about who would run Hong Kong. That person was always handpicked by Beijing. And as Hong Kongers have over the years increasingly called for more rights and more democracy, China's leaders have looked for ways to curb such tendencies. There was an anti-sedition bill a few years after the handover, and then an extradition bill that sparked these protests that are still going on now.
Overnight and through the morning darkness, the streets of Hong Kong remained a battlefield.
Can I ask why you're out here today?
We have been lacking all our freedom slowly and slowly, so this is like pretty much the very last chance for us to come out and stand for what we believe, which is like freedom, freedom of speech, freedom to protest. It's just simple reason.
The Hong Kong government withdrew the bill in the face of protests by a couple million Hong Kongers. Still, the protests continue because now many Hong Kongers say this is about much more than one bill. It's about whether the Hong Kong they've known survives. And now to my conversation with Jeff Wasserstrom.
You know, Jeff, you've been going in and out of Hong Kong for 30 years, quite frequently over the last 5 years, two or three times a year. I go back in Hong Kong 25 years. No one needs to convince us why Hong Kong's important, but if someone asks you, who hasn't been covering Hong Kong, who hasn't been going there very much or following it, why should I care? What would you say?
So I think there are a bunch of reasons to care about Hong Kong. It's a very inspiring struggle going on right now. against enormous odds. And this kind of David versus Goliath story, or as young Hong Kongers think of it, Hunger Games story, about young people taking bold actions to try to stand up for what they believe in against seemingly impossible odds, is something that's going to be inspiring, and that is inspiring people in many places. And not just authoritarian places, it can also inspire people fighting against climate change. And the climate strike movement, there's sort of been exchanges between Greta Thunberg and Joshua Wong finding each other inspiring and things
and
like
Joshua
that.
And Joshua Wong was one of the leaders of the Umbrella Movement in 2014.
Exactly. And but another thing, another reason that speaks to the present is there's a great value. One of the things that's being fought for in Hong Kong is the ability to have a press that operates more freely than the press operates on the mainland. The ability to have a strong press in a place beside the Chinese mainland at a time when something's being covered up on the Chinese mainland is something that can be valuable in Hong Kong, but valuable to the world. And I think we saw that with the SARS crisis, which is on minds again with the coronavirus issue, that having people who are near to the Chinese mainland but not as constrained as journalists on the Chinese mainland are, is very important when there's anything being covered up, any kind of misdeeds. And, you know, there are bold journalists who I really admire who are trying to get stories out from the mainland now about issues that the government wants to control. But it's very important to have a space near there where we can get information out there that's even freer.
How do people vote in Hong Kong? What do they have if not universal suffrage?
I've spent a lot of time thinking about how the Communist Party is exerting greater and greater control over Hong Kong. But it's extraordinary that a city was part of a Communist Party-run country and yet had these very different elections for as long as they did. But the key sticking point has been that the chief executive, the person who has the most power of all in Hong Kong, is elected, but by a very small group of people. Around 2,000 people actually do the electing. And the only people who can stand for that post are people who basically have been vetted and Beijing feels will be enough in line with sensitive to central policies. So that's part of the problem. And the Legislative Council also has a very complicated structure where some people are elected directly, but some are elected by different constituencies, groups. Occupational groups like accountants have somebody that they get to have on the council. It's set up so that there can never be a clear majority of people on the council. It's stacked against there ever being a clear majority that are pro-democracy.
Do you think the Chinese government ever intended to allow Hong Kong to have universal suffrage in the way that Hong Kong people who go out in the streets and protest for more democracy expected it?
I think from the beginning, there was a level of ambiguity to the wording, and including the one country, two systems. The idea was that each side could sort of dream a different dream and project it onto that document. And there was a discussion that the people of Hong Kong would get to choose who governed them. But the idea of kind of robust competitive elections and things like that, it's hard to imagine the Chinese Communist Party ever being able to really put up with that. But the Chinese Communist Party itself, it's also important to remember, we didn't know what trajectory it was going to go on to. The Chinese Communist Party has been a tremendously experimental organization from the get-go. There were all kinds of experiments, some of them horrific in their impact, things like the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. But some of them seemed to be experiments after Mao that were experimenting with village elections under Deng Xiaoping. And by 1984, when the agreement was worked out to hand Hong Kong back, a lot of people in the West, including Margaret Thatcher, but she wasn't alone in this, thought China is starting to embrace more forms of free markets and capitalist economy. It will gradually, the middle class will grow, and it will gradually, as it becomes more in step with free markets, it will start being more politically liberalized. There was a period from 84 until 89, until the massacre, June 4th, 89, really, when it seemed possible that China was on this trajectory of getting more and more liberalized. And who knew what kind of country the one country of those two with two systems would be. After 89, there was a sense of giving real pause to that. It really showed the hard edge of the Chinese Communist Party when faced by massive challenges. Margaret Thatcher, I talk about this in Vigil. Margaret Thatcher was on a call-in show 1 year after the massacre, and somebody asked her on BBC, you know, what do you think about the situation for the Chinese people? And she said, well, of course, I'm very concerned about what kind of China Hong Kong will be joining. And she doubled down on this view, which, again, many people on both sides of the political spectrum felt in the West, that when the economy liberalized over time, gradually at least, the political system would liberalize. And she was wrong about that. And lots of people were wrong about that. Bill Clinton was wrong about that, just to show that I'm not just picking on conservatives. But she said one other thing in that. She said, the Chinese Communist Party will honor its promises to Hong Kong because it will want to be seen in the forum of the world to have honored its promises to Hong Kong. It was she was saying this at a time where, and you could imagine it, in the late 20th century and even early 21st century, when Beijing, whatever the leaders in Beijing wanted to do, they were very sensitive that they wanted to be accepted into the international order more. They wanted to be able to host the Olympics. They wanted to be able to be in WTO. So they would have to be, they would have to live up to a variety of promises and at least not engage in certain kinds of repression in a place like Hong Kong after it became part of the mainland. The Chinese Communist Party now is in a very different position. The forum of the world is a very different position. The international order is much less stable. And China, the Chinese Communist Party feels much more able to flaunt the opinion of the foreign of the world when it wants to.
But at the same time, China is trying to build out the Belt and Road, the New Silk Road all over the world in more than 100 countries, building infrastructure, roads, railways, ports, dams, and more, and really to try to shift the center of gravity of global trade and global power to China. And for that to happen, people in other countries need to trust China. And when they look at Hong Kong, and when they look at what's happening with the coronavirus, what happened long ago with SARS in 2003, it's like, okay, so you cover things up in ways that hurt people outside of your borders. And when we look at the extent to which you're holding true to what everyone in Hong Kong thought was agreed to, or what many people in Hong Kong thought was agreed to, how do we know we can trust you if we do a deal with you?
So yeah, Belt and Road, this is an enormous issue, and the world is very distracted by crises in many places, which provides a certain amount of wiggle room for an authoritarian regime to do things that in an earlier, quieter age would have more kind of focus of outrage. So the Chinese Communist Party does care about international opinion to a certain extent, and I think the way in which the coronavirus has been handled illustrates this idea of trying to contain the issue within the borders of China, and often using very draconian methods against its own population, is a way of trying to mitigate the degree of outrage internationally that could interfere with its ambitions broader. I think in dealing with the Hong Kong protests, a message seems to have been sent, however it was spelled out, to the Hong Kong police force, which has behaved very brutally at times against protests, a couple of messages. One is, we want you to handle this. We don't want People's Liberation Army troops to be needed to go in there, because that would be seen as having a bigger cost to the Chinese Communist Party. And also, they don't want the kind of images circulating the world that did after the Tiananmen protests. So it's been very striking that there's been a high degree of brutality used by the Hong Kong police force, but there's been very few firing of live ammunition rounds. There's been firing of beanbag shot, rubber bullets, an enormous amount of tear gas.
Yeah, I was there the first day they used rubber bullets, June 12th.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I had just left to come back to the U.S. Before that. But these aren't killing people. You know, there are martyrs. The movement has claimed several martyrs, and there are cases, but they aren't the kind of obvious case like young bodies gunned down on the streets.
It's suicides, mostly.
There are suicides, and there was a young man who fell to his death off a parking garage that was being tear gassed. Mm. And these people are treated with, the last thing that I saw in Hong Kong, I was back there in December, the last thing I saw was a moment of silence. Several hundred high school students had organized a very moving vigil, a protest, to sort of express their enduring commitment to the movement. And it began with a moment of silence with bowed heads for those who had suffered. Those who had died, but also had suffered. There's been an Indonesian journalist who was blinded in one eye by, I think it was being shot. So there is a sense of that within the movement of commemorating those who suffer. But there hasn't been the live fire that would create the kind of thing that would be, that would cause enormous problems, I think the presumption is, by Beijing, that would get in the way of these international initiatives. Where it goes from here, it's very hard for me to imagine a scenario in which things get better in Hong Kong in terms of the, in terms of there being moves toward a real kind of democratic selection of the chief executive. The Beijing authorities have stuck with a very unpopular chief executive who seems tone deaf to popular concerns, who seems relatively uninterested at times in really representing the constituency she's supposed to represent and more concerned with representing Beijing. So it's very hard to imagine these accomplishing things. On the other hand, the historian in me has to say many movements persisted even when it seemed utterly impossible that they would achieve their goals. They can take a very long time to achieve their goals and only achieve their goals when something changes in another part of the world. Anti-colonial movements in different parts of the world have seemed to have be fighting against impossible odds. So I think I don't see how the Hong Kong protesters can win in the short run. But I think some of them are thinking about this as, first of all, that they won't feel good about themselves if they stop too soon. There's a sense that the umbrella movement stopped too soon. And that even there's a kind of sense that there's a nobility to fighting, to fight even for a lost cause, if we think of it as the way we think about, say, anti-colonial movements. And at the moment, Beijing is operating toward Hong Kong very much like a colonial possession.
So on behalf of World Affairs, please join me in thanking Dr. Jeff Wasserstrom for his insights and for his book, For Vigil, Hong Kong on the Brink. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs. That was journalist Mary Kay Magstad in conversation with Jeffrey Wasserstrom. He's a historian specializing in modern Chinese history and a professor at UC Irvine. We recorded their conversation at a live event before the pandemic. Earlier, we heard from Claire, a Hong Kong artist and activist, and Sophie Richardson, the China director for Human Rights Watch. To hear this program or any other episode, you can download our podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. While you're there, please leave us a rating. It helps others find our program. World Affairs is a nonprofit organization. Please consider supporting the program you value by joining our community at worldaffairs.org. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from Chevron. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Hannah Harasaki and Catherine Putz provided research assistance. Teresa Katsourilis is our producer. Jared Sport is our senior producer. Our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for joining us.